Oh, man, one of my favorite mornings of all times right there, man. There is nothing like the kids. Like, I think about the Christmas story, and one of the things that's familiar there is the angels all celebrate on the evening that Jesus was born, and you're like, who could top that? And the RC kids are like, hold my juice box and watch this. We're just gonna top that action. They did so awesome all the way around. It really is one of my favorite Sundays when the kids are a part of this and everything else. And I love the fact that it just kind of, again, anchors everything that we're seeking to do at this time of year, this idea of the season of Advent. You can hear the little pitter-patter feet up there right now. That's even kind of fun as it is. But I think about this holiday even, and it's such a unique kind of holiday for us as a people, because it's the only one, if you think about it, how we have protracted it to literally take up about 10% of our year. Like, have you thought about that? Like, sincerely, right? If there's 52 weeks in a year, we spend well over 5.2 weeks, like doing this whole thing. Like, how many of you set up actually before Thanksgiving? It's okay to admit it. I'm good with that. We've done that before, too. This year, we were very behind, right? How many of you don't usually pull stuff down till maybe the first week of January? Second week, third week. How many of you, there's got to be a couple, how many of you just leave a tree up all year and you just change the decor? I saw somebody force another person's hand up right there. So that is fantastic right there. But I understand this, right? Like, there's something about the Christmas season and particularly the singular day that I think it draws in all of our senses, right? Like, you think about, like, it's just like you smell the peppermint, you taste the cocoa, you feel the hugs, you hear the music. You just, all the senses just kind of get wrapped into this whole thing. And as I think about it, I think there's a real distinct reason why we crave this particular day. And I think it's because we long for that deeper thing that we know was lost, right? We've been talking about that all the way through Advent, that there's a sense in which we sense in our bones and our soul that we had this thing, this place called Eden, and there was connectedness and contentedness and this sense of peace that was there and hope and joy. All those things were there, and we know that it was lost. And ever since then, we're trying to kind of recraft it and reconnect ourselves to it and try to bring forth those ideas into our lives in new ways. And I think that's what Christmas morning is kind of all about. It's like trying to get all those things to come back together, so much so that in the middle of our living rooms, we put a tree just like in Eden, right? Like, it's our own little Eden that we hope to see kind of accomplished on that particular morning. And so kind of with that, I was thinking about the fact that what drives us probably so much at this time of year, especially as followers of Jesus, is just that sense of loss and that longing for that thing again. And that's really what Christmas was all about. That first Christmas is getting us back to the healing from that which was lost, right? It's regathering us to that thing that our heart craves. In fact, when I think about the first Christmas, I think it's odd. Like, we sing one of the songs, "Come all ye faithful, joyful, and triumphant." But if you go back to that first night and the conditions of the human heart that were happening at that point, I think a better song rendition would be, "Come all ye faithless, joyless, and defeated." Because that was really the condition of things. See, the first Advent, the arrival of God in the person of Jesus, is God coming into a broken world, a bleak world, a burdened world, where we were weighed down by our hopelessness and our joylessness and our absence of peace. I mean, all these things that were getting us. And then God, in rich, great love and grace, says, "I'm going to intervene, I'm going to step in, and I'm going to meet them where they're at, and I'm going to address their need. I'm going to bring true joy. I'm going to bring deep peace. I'm going to bring enduring hope. And I'm going to do this through the relentless gift of my love." See, when I think about that first Christmas, it's not like we can picture it as God comes into the world and everybody says, "Yay, you're finally here. Yay, this is what we've been craving. We want you on your terms." That's not what happened. It wasn't like they made him the guest of honor, and that's how it all kind of flowed. No, he comes in conditions where we were going to be a bit rejecting of God. We were going to be choosing our own path and our own ways, and despite that, he comes then as this lowly servant. He comes to break into our space in a way that we need, in a way that will heal and reform us.
And so, again, when Jesus comes into the world in that first Christmas, it's not quite like the stuff of Hallmark cards and ornate nativities. It's not just simply silent and calm and bright and postcard worthy. I mean, just start reconstructing the story a little bit. Here is this young Jewish man, Joseph. He's blue collar. He swings a hammer. He's not uniquely educated, doesn't come from some affluent family. He's just a regular Joe, literally. The most regular Joe you could probably come across. That's the situation. And he's not from Jerusalem. He's not from some fancy city. No, he lives in the sticks. Where he's from is basically looked down on. It's like those are where the hicks live and the weirdos live and everything else. Even the Piggly Wiggly wouldn't put in a franchise there. They're like, no, that town's way too weird, right? And then you have Mary, barely a teenager. We estimate maybe like 13 years old. Can you imagine? Just at that age, you are untested and undereducated, ill-prepared for the things of life. And then you add to the story even more that what her situation is quite literally, just in a very interesting way, a very unplanned pregnancy, right? Like, when you go and read the story, it's not like the angel comes to Mary and says, hey, we've got an idea, what do you think, are you on board, right? It's just like, this is what's happening. This is what is occurring with you. This is what God is doing with you, whether you're on or off. This is the event that's occurring. Now, she is a remarkable woman in her own right and embraces that and has an amazing celebratory prayer and song of worship to God in light of that. But that's a lot to absorb for this young lady on this particular series of events or in the series of events. And so what we have is basically two nobodies from nowhere with nothing, and yet that's exactly the set of conditions and persons that God is going to use to bring his great counter-offensive into the world. And I think because he does it that way, like honestly, I think even with the fact that he's choosing those kinds of conditions, those kinds of players, not power players, right? Like the unexpected to be a part of the story. I think it highlights the essence and the spirit of how Jesus is wanting to come and do business in the world. Like he comes so upside down and backwards from the way that anybody would anticipate. In fact, in Philippians chapter 2, you see the spirit of this. Paul is writing to a group of Christians that are struggling with some division in their ranks, some hardships, some hurts, some differences, whatever else. And so he lets them know, you must have the same attitude that Christ Jesus had. And though he was God, he did not think of equality with God as something to cling to, but instead he gave up his divine privileges. He took the humble position of a slave and was born as a human being. And when he appeared in human form and being found in human form, he humbled himself in obedience to God and died a criminal's death on the cross. I mean, that's remarkable to me. Like, honestly, I've meditated on that many times in my life, and I thought, if I had all of that power, would I really stoop that low? But that shows us this love of God that we're talking about on this Advent Sunday. Like, God so loves, so cares, so is willing to give. He says, here's my privilege. I set it to the side, and I'm coming to serve them, even if it means die for them. And so here is this baby born to two nobodies in the middle of nothing, to show a bunch of somebodies, which is all of you in this room and people all throughout the globe and all throughout history, to show them just how deeply he loves them. Now, in that sense, we might look at the story and go, well, that's a very quaint story. It's like this romantic, tragic thing. But I go, no, when we get back into the story a little bit, it's a story of just radical hardship. Like, radical hardship. I mean, again, I want you to think about Mary and her conditions. When she hears the angel say, hey, you are with child, you haven't known a man, you haven't known your fiance, but you're with child, do you think she's going to be like, no problem? No, she's going to be terrified. Terrified, right? She lives in a patriarchal society, right? The people of her community are not going to be like, oh, she's a teen mom without a husband, no big deal. She got pregnant outside of wedlock, no big deal. And are they going to believe the story of, well, God made me pregnant? Like, nobody's going to believe that story, right? So she knows she's going to be ostracized. She's going to be labeled.
that the people of her community are going to just simply look down on her. They might even worry that God won't bless their community because, again, God blesses blessable communities and he curses curseable communities. That's how they understood the law of Moses. And now this girl's done this thing that might bring the cursing of God to their community. And so all the more there's going to be like this thing in her that says, man, this is going to be a hard ride. It's going to be incredibly hard as the ride. And then there's Joseph. I'm sure he's overwhelmed, right? Like, think about it. At first, he finds out she's pregnant, and he's like, I just can't marry her. I just can't go through with this. I mean, again, I love her. I care about her. I don't want to make her look any worse than she's going to look, but I just can't continue with this. But then the angel speaks to him and says, listen, this is really of God. This is not of any other doing. And so take her as your wife. See, for him, it's going to be uniquely challenging because then people are going to look at him and say, we know you're not the father. And so you got suckered, or you're gullible, or you're naive, right? Or now you're tainted because you don't have wisdom. You're now adjacent to a thing that is a problem. And so from that, he is a carpenter, and I'm sure his work is going to suffer. His reputation is going to suffer. The sense of respect toward him is going to suffer. Why? Because he married the floozy girl with the bastard kid. Right? Small towns, man. If you've ever been in one, you know how news travels, right? I guess we live in one. Never mind. And so you just think about this. From a human condition perspective, he will suffer, she will suffer. And I believe that foreshadows the fact that that child will grow into one who what? Suffers. Now, in this, I'm sure we might go, well, you know, but the toughest part of the plan is just hearing the plan and signing on board to the plan. Once you've signed on board to the plan and you know the conditions, it's going to be fine, right? No. It is way easier to sign up on the front end than to begin experiencing all of the suffering on the back end. And so God says, hey, this is what we're doing. This is where we're going. She's on board. He's on board. But they still must go through the details. And so what are the details? Well, we know that there's this whole census, and now they have to travel some distance to be a part of a census for taxation purposes, which is going to empty their bank accounts even more at the hands of Rome. So that's a hardship as it is. But in her third trimester, they have to travel 100 miles to be a part of that census. Like, it's interesting for me. So my daughter, Honor, just had a little one just a couple of months ago. So born in October. And I go, imagine if my daughter in September had to travel from Duval to Yakima, right? And not with a car or a bus or whatever else, like on foot, man, on foot. You know how hard that would be? Now, I know some of you are like, oh, but she rode a donkey. Listen, bro, ain't no donkey in the story. This isn't Shrek. This, like, the Bible has no donkey, no camel, the kids were awesome, but no camel in the story either. There's nothing. They're hoofing it across all of that. Also, when they get there, no drummer boy. I know that's a disappointment. Love the song, no drummer boy there. But they're going through this whole crazy thing. And then by the time they're arriving, now she's in labor, but there is no inn in which she can labor. And so from that, what do they do? Well, they're out of time and out of options. And so they find a space that is riddled with the stench of livestock. Right? I mean, ladies, honestly, if you've ever had a child, imagine doing it in those conditions. Cold, dark, fatigued, right? Just question marks all around. See, the reality of the first Christmas was the reality of humanity, right? Fear, fatigue, rejection, pain, insecurity, blood, sweat, tears, hardship. I was there for the birth of my three kids. I was very hands-off for the most part. I think I got to cut an umbilical once, maybe. Here's Joseph, right? Completely out of his depth. Here he is with his wife. He's like, my hands make things. My hands don't bring life into the world. Like, they don't train nice Jewish boys to be midwives in their culture, right? Like, here he is, and she's like, she's given birth. He's the only options he's got. So these callous, rough hands that work with wood and stone are now trying to fumble this sweet little baby coming from his wife. And then his wife is there, and she doesn't have her mother with her or her sisters with her or anybody else, just her husband, who is, again, way outside of his pay grade. And she's fearful, I'm sure, and tears and sweat and
cold and just, man, so hard. Nobody there to guide them or comfort them or hurt with them. But this is the way God is doing it, all for this precious child, this baby who is God, who is going to be the slave king, the servant king of all. And so the all-powerful God enters into the world with rags for clothes, a feeding trough for a crib, and a cave for a nursery. See, again, I always try to get into the shoes of that first Christmas because it reminds us how broken our world is, how fragile life can be, how desperate our situation was, and in that, then, how crazy loving our God is. That he stoops to be among us, stoops to be alongside us, even stoops so far as to come underneath us and lift us up. And so he trades heaven's splendors for earth's spite. He gives up his robe for rags. Eventually, he gives up his angelic songs, rather, for these angry mobs that cry for his removal and death. Ultimately, he gives up the crystal sea for the cross's scars. And he does all of that in love for you and in love for me. And that love is not some shallow, sappy kind of love. Like, hey, love y'all, right? Like, he proves it. It's a love of affection and conviction and relentless pursuit. A love that says, man, I want to rescue you from, yes, your sin, but also your baggage, also your shame, also your worry, also your doubt, also your failure. Like, I want to alleviate all of those burdens. Like, Paul shows us the problem in Ephesians chapter 2. He says, once you were dead because of your disobedience and many sins. You used to live in sin just like the rest of the world, obeying the devil, right? He says, man, we all used to live that way, following our passionate desires, our inclinations of our sinful nature, and we were from that subject to God's anger, just like everyone else. And so he's like, that was our plight. That was our problem. Those were the conditions. But then, in love, God pursues his rejectors. In love, God comes into a world that wasn't wanting to give them what they were needing. Thus, Paul goes on and says, but God, in verse 4, which I love that. We were this, that was the problem, but God is now the solution, being rich in mercy because of the great love with which he loved us. Even when we were dead in our trespasses, he has made us alive together by Christ. By grace, you have been saved. I just love that reality, right? That again, it's not like I earned it, I was good enough for it, I was doing anything to kind of acquire it. It's like God's like, man, I'm just kicking in your door, I'm breaking into your world, and I'm showing you a radical love in servanthood. This is why John says, man, this is real love. It's real love, not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his son as a sacrifice to take away our sin. See, that's the conviction of God. Right? He stands behind his love, man. He stands behind his love, and he gives his fullness into that. And he does that, bringing love into our lives so that he can bring love then through our lives, so that we can know this love, and then from that we can begin to radiate and act on these very ideas of love. So in chapter 2, he's like, hey, we had a problem. Also in chapter 2, he says, hey, there is a solution. It's rooted in the love of God. He goes, and then because of that, man, I want you to know that love. This is what he says in Ephesians chapter 3. He says, when I think of all of this, like all this stuff that God has done, right? I fall to my knees and pray to the Father, the creator of everything in heaven and earth. I pray that from his glorious unlimited resources, he will empower you with the inner strength through his spirit. I go, well, why do you pray for that? And he says, well, then Christ will make his home in your hearts as you trust him. And we go, well, great, but why do you want that, right? He says, well, because as Christ makes his home in your hearts, you will trust in him and your roots will go down into God's love. And that will keep you strong. And from that, you're going to have the power to understand, as God's people should, how wide and long and high and deep his love really is. And you experience the love of Christ, though it is too great to fully understand. He says, then you'll be made complete with all the fullness and life and power that comes from God. I just dig that idea, right? Like doubly there. He goes, man, I want you to know how wide and high and deep and long it really is, but you're still not going to fully fathom it. I pray that you get it, but you're not fully going to get it. But hopefully from that, it moves you and motivates you, right? It changes your life, it rules in your world, and it spills out to the people around you. I think that is fantastic. It just reminds me again that he came in love because of our pain and our despair and our hurts and our hardships and our vices and our dysfunction and our addictions. But he did it in love for the sake of love, so that we can then be touched by a love that can love without limits, just as he loved us without limits. I think this love without limits kind of comes out in three ways really quick. First of all, our love without limits that he gives to us that we are to exercise is first to be directed toward him, right? He loves us without limits, so we in turn love him without limits. In 1 John chapter 5, it says, we love God's children if we love God and obey his commandments. Loving God means keeping his commandments, and his commandments are not burdensome. So I think this is helpful because, again, this love without limits means, man, I'm going to love God no matter what. Not that there isn't things that he asks me that are not difficult at times or challenging or I need to do certain things, but in that I go, I so love him because he so loves me. I am okay doing that. I am okay doing that because the greater thing is always going to be, man, I love him so much, I just want him to know that I love him. That's one way we love without limits. The second way we use our love without limits is we direct it toward others who love us. He says in 1 John 4:11, beloved, if God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. I think this is really valuable. I've thought about this often. There is a thing about my life that bothers me heavily, and that is the people that I love the most sometimes get hurt by me the most. Super dumb, right? Super dumb, right? Like the people that are closest to us that we hold most tenderly are also the people we sometimes say careless things to, and we slight in some way. They get our unfiltered us in some of the worst moments. But I go, man, if this love has touched my life and I'm supposed to live this love toward others, I really should do a great job then of loving those who love me. But then third, and this is the toughest one, our love without limits should be directed toward those who don't love us. See, I think about this whole idea of the incarnation. What the incarnation is God in love coming to people that don't love God and loving those people into loving God. Like, that's what he does. And we're to be the same. Jesus says this, but to you who are willing to listen, I say this, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who hurt you. Why does he say that? He says that because, you know what? That's what God did with each one of us. He blessed us. He did good to us. He prays for us. When we were disinterested, he was invested depositing love into our world. And so when we do all three, when we love God and we love the lovely and we love those who are maybe unlovely to us, I think from that we experience more of the love of God, and then the cycle continues. In 1 John chapter 4, verse 16, he says, we know how much God loves us, and we have put our trust in his love. God is love, and all who live in love live in God, and God lives in them. Now, I know you read that, and it sounds like Yoda, right? Oh, live in God, live in love. You know what I mean? It's like, I get that. It seems a little confusing, right? But again, the idea there is just, man, it's like the more we lean into this idea of God loves me, and I'm going to love him and others and the unlovely, the more it's like, man, then I take up more residence in you. I live in you more. I produce more love in you. And again, it just cycles and cycles and cycles. It's a flywheel that spins up momentum. And so that's what the first Christmas is all about. That's what the advent of the candle of God's love is all about. God coming to us, living among us, and investing in us, the unlovely, in love, so we'd be touched by that love and we could be lovely to others. And so here's my challenge this morning as I start to wrap up here, all right? Everything we want to do is we leave this place and we go do what we do and we're out in our world and everything else as we reflect on the love of God coming to the world and the person of Jesus. Here's the thing. Everything in life is an opportunity to display love. Everything is, right? And so, when you are hurt, what a great opportunity to love. When you're wronged, man, that's a great opportunity to love. When you're like, I was betrayed, that's an opportunity to love. If you're slighted or overlooked or accused or disrespected, you're tired, you're slandered, you're misunderstood, you're frustrated, you're unappreciated, man, those are all opportunities to love. I close with Paul's words on what love is all about. He says, love is patient and it's kind. Love is not jealous or boastful or proud or rude. It does not demand its own way. It is not irritable and it keeps no record of wrongs. It does not rejoice about injustice, but rejoices whenever the truth wins out. Love never gives up. Love never loses faith. It is always hopeful, and it endures through every circumstance. See, the love that God brought to us is the love that he wants to bring through us. And so when we think about this holiday, this thing that we celebrate, man, at the core of that is a God that loves, and he calls us to love. Let's pray together. Jesus, I thank you. I thank you for your love. I thank you for your grace. I thank you that you give us hope and peace and joy as we press into you. And I know for some of us, these things may feel distant right now. For others, they feel very close, and maybe we're anywhere on the spectrum in between those things. But I pray in all of it, our commitment is to be more of what you have rescued us to be. We would dwell with you in such a way that we sense what we're meant to be, and that you would motivate us, even despite our own challenges, our hardships, even our propensities at times to veer out of your lane, that we would want to get back into that, because that is what we are meant to be in you. We thank you for this holiday. We thank you for these reminders, and we thank you for your grace and your good name. Amen.